There have been demonstrations on the street. You know, that doesn't happen in China. This is not New York City. You don't just, like, go and demonstrate, you know, unless you like to go to jail.
In southern China, protests erupt over newspaper censorship. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Politicians and citizens are angry at a New York paper for publishing the names and addresses of gun permit holders.
They've created an interactive map where the worst of the worst can now go online and virtually end up on the doorstep in less than 30 seconds.
Plus, a conversation with a filmmaker who's documented the lives of a handful of British children for 49 years.
I'm sure I've made lots of mistakes and behaved insensitively, but whatever rough times we've had, we're still bonded like some bizarre family.
All that and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. At a press conference in Washington on Thursday afternoon, Vice President Joe Biden sketched out his first suggestion of what gun policy reform might look like after Newtown.
Coming from the groups we've met with, there is a surprising recurrence of suggestions that we have universal background checks. Not just close the gun show loophole, but total universal background checks.
CNN cut away from Biden's speech to go to commercial and returned with breaking news on the other side of the country in Taft, California.
There has been a school shooting at Taft High School. This shooting happened this morning around 9 a.m. local time, we're told. According to reports, at least two people were shot.
Next Tuesday, Biden's task force will deliver its gun policy suggestions to the White House. One potential reform concerns something that you might mistakenly assume already exists, a central database of gun transactions in the United States maintained by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The National Rifle Association has blocked all such efforts in the past. In fact, the government's record-keeping on gun ownership is stunningly antiquated. Cheryl Gay Stolberg wrote about it for the New York Times. Cheryl, welcome to On the Media.
I'm happy to be here.
So if this were CSI or some other TV show and the cops had a gun from a crime scene, you know, you see them at one of their magical computers typing in a serial number, and lo and behold, up pops the photo of the person the gun is registered to and all their particulars. I gather it ain't like that in real life.
Right. In real life, the ATF has to follow a very circuitous manual routine to track gun ownership. There is no central database of gun transactions.
Now, this is not because the federal government hasn't thought of that. This is the result of being essentially handcuffed by the law. Can you tell me what the law is in early 2013 and how it got there?
So in 1986, Congress adopted the Firearms Owners Protection Act, and that law prevents the ATF from establishing a central database. Instead, the ATF has to comb through records, computer printouts, hand-scrawled index cards, sometimes water-stained sheets of paper, to gather up necessary data on firearms transactions.
And the reason for this is that legislators friendly to the NRA have tucked certain provisions into bills that have nothing to do with gun control in order to make sure that the ATF's job is as cumbersome as possible. What is their thinking?
Well, I think the argument made by the NRA is that a central database is tantamount to Big Brother. It could be used by the government to send agents into people's homes and repossess their guns. It's interesting that the NRA, in speaking about the Newtown case, suggested a central database of people who are mentally ill, but it nonetheless opposes a database of registered gun owners.
Let me play the devil's advocate here for a moment, because if the Second Amendment was intended by the framers to allow the public to do exactly what they had done and rebel against tyranny, then it would certainly make sense in that context for the government not to be able to preemptively stop the rebels from taking a stand.
But the counter-argument is that the guns that are being used in massacres like the Newtown Massacre are not being kept by people for their Second Amendment right to defend themselves or to even rise up against the tyranny of government. They are military assault-style weapons that can fire off round after round after round in a matter of seconds, and that the only real purpose for these guns is killing people.
At the moment, something is going on in New York State that seems to create a bit of a conflict between the First Amendment and the Second one. A newspaper called the Journal News, and then subsequently the website Gawker, published information about gun owners that it had harvested from public records, enraging the gun owners for a number of reasons, not the least of which is they feared for their own personal security, but clearly permitted as a matter of available public information. Does the furor over the Journal News episode foreshadow the debate ahead on gun registration and easily accessible databases?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I guess perhaps it does. I have to confess that I was very conflicted when I read about that case as a journalist. On the one hand, this newspaper published readily available data. Newspapers do that all the time. But the paper also published the precise street addresses of gun owners, and I do have to say that we're often careful with precise street addresses, and there are some things that newspapers traditionally haven't published. For instance, we don't publish the names of rape victims, although in some places that's changing. So I'm not sure what the right move was journalistically, but I do think that the backlash against that publication is sort of parallel to the strong feelings about a gun registry.
I'm wondering, Cheryl, if this just bespeaks a conflict between the public's right to know and the gun owner's right, as they have asserted, to privacy.
Absolutely, there's a conflict. We have these conflicts all the time, and the Supreme Court settles them, and that is the debate that the President and the Congress and the American public will be wrestling with in the weeks and months to come.
All right. Cheryl, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a Washington correspondent for The New York Times. As I just mentioned, following the school massacre in nearby Connecticut, a New York State paper published a map showing the names and addresses of handgun permit owners in its readership area. The Journal News obtained that data the way any citizen can, via a Freedom of Information request. But such information had never before been consolidated and published in such a user-friendly way. However, one jurisdiction in the Journal News circulation area, Putnam County, has refused to comply with that FOIA request. This decision violates explicit New York state law, but has a supporter in State Senator Greg Ball, who has been an outspoken advocate of Putnam County's decision. Senator Ball, welcome to On the Media.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks so much.
Why were people so angry that this material was published?
Look, we're talking about tens of thousands of people, including victims of domestic violence who got a permit to protect themselves and their young families. We have many retired New York City police officers who spent years putting murderers, rapists, thugs behind bars. And now, because of this interactive map and these laws that allowed access to this information, didn't exist in the age of Google Earth, Google Maps. They've created an interactive map where the worst of the worst can now go online and virtually end up on the doorstep in less than 30 seconds.
You mean you might have a restraining order against an ex-spouse or an ex-boyfriend and are hiding from him, and all of a sudden the Journal News prints your name and address?
And it's happened. And we have gotten dozens of calls of that nature, of mostly women, but men and women who are fearful for their lives, and many retired New York City police officers all throughout the Hudson Valley who are absolutely incensed that the Journal News would do this.
For the sake of argument, let me just stipulate that it was a dumb idea for all of the reasons that you've listed, and that news organizations often have access to information that they do not print for a whole host of reasons, whether it's a rape victim's name or a minor child who is arrested for a crime or national security information or you name it. So clearly, the Journal News could have, as Archie Bunker might have said, stifled itself, Edith.
Yeah.
But it didn't. And now the Putnam County officials are saying, you made us angry. We are not going to provide this data to you. And you support that. But the law's the law, isn't it?
Yeah, the law's the law. You know, and as elected officials, we have the responsibility to uphold the law, but we also have the responsibility to exercise judgment to protect our citizens. And what Putnam County is going to do is we're going to exercise every legal option to maintain the confidentiality of the people, hundreds of whom are calling the county clerk, the county executive, and myself every single day.
I think I've conceded the point that the journalistic decision is dubious.
Sure.
But that said, current law is pretty clear on this, and I guess I can see how you can try to change the law for the future so that similar episodes don't take place. But how can you essentially suppress public information when the law is so explicit about the public's right to know?
From what we have been told, if the Journal News did this for monetary gain, which it seems obvious they did because they're in the business of selling papers, then you know the request can be denied.
Well, that would be a novel argument. It might have made the Pentagon Papers decision come out a little differently, since newspapers are, of course, for-profit institutions.
As far as from a legal debate with you, I'll leave that to guys that are paying a lot more per hour than me. I'll just tell you, as a state senator, legal, not legal, I'm going to fight until hell freezes over and then fight on the ice, and the Journal News was wrong to do it. And we have a responsibility as elected officials, certainly to obey the law, but also to put a little common sense in place. And when you have victims of domestic violence and cops that are sitting in their homes looking for somebody to protect them, the Journal News is in dereliction of that duty, and I'm going to stand up and do the right thing, in my view, and you know, we'll fight as long as we can.
If you're right, if this was an utterly gratuitous move by the Journal News that has no journalistic justification and so forth, is there some risk here of suppressing other important public information along the way to making sure that an incident precisely like this doesn't happen again?
You know, look, I mean, we've got to make sure that we have open government, and we have to make sure that the public has access to all the information that's appropriate. There, you know, has been a precedent set in the past of sensitive information, whether it be family court documents, tax records, or otherwise that are kept private. And I certainly think that this falls into that category. I don't seek to further expansion beyond that, but this is certainly a category in current times with social media and the world of Google Maps and Google Earth that I think there's a protection that needs to be put in place.
All right, Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Greg Ball is a Republican state legislator in New York representing Putnam County.
Coming up, Al Jazeera will now be widely available on American cable TV, but critics say its coverage is increasingly controlled by the Qatari government, especially in its coverage of Syria.
There is a pattern that we noticed with them being clearly sympathetic of the rebels. I must say that I am personally sympathetic to anyone trying to bring down this evil regime, but that is not the job of a channel that I'm supposed to turn to for neutral news.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this week in southern China, something weird happened.
Yellow chrysanthemums symbolizing the death of press freedom were laid outside the headquarters of the Southern Weekly newspaper in the city of Guangzhou.
They were protesting the censoring of a New Year's Day op-ed last week in the Southern Weekly. In its original form, it hoped for a new year in which the liberal principles of the Chinese constitution actually were respected. When that op-ed was reduced to party platitudes by propaganda officials, the paper's employees briefly went on strike. The paper resumed publication at week's end after an agreement was reached between the newspaper and the local government, which in fact owns the paper. Jeremy Goldcorn is the director of Danwei, a firm that researches Chinese media and the internet. He says that despite state ownership, the stakes in censoring Southern Weekly were high. It does some of the best investigative reporting in China.
They were the first Chinese media organization to describe what was going on with SARS, kind of a flu that was killing people. China completely suppressed that kind of information, and the Southern Weekly published a few stories that helped to open up the conversation inside China.
They also did a ground-changing piece about police misconduct.
There was a young guy, his name was Sun Zhigang. He was a graphic designer, and he'd come to Guangzhou, the big city, working as a graphic designer, but he did not have a residence permit. And this guy got detained by police, and then he died in police custody. This is a newspaper that has consistently published stories that reveal problems in society that are generally considered too dangerous for most newspapers to do. This kind of thing has gone on basically every year at some point. You know, the current goings on, I feel it's being hyped up a little bit by the Western media.
This strike that brings civilians into the street, isn't there a much higher profile element to this?
Yes, Brooke, even though you are an American, you're not completely wrong about this. It is a big deal. There have been demonstrations on the street. You know, that doesn't happen in China. This is not New York City. You don't just, like, go and demonstrate, you know, unless you like to go to jail. Li Bingbing, an actress, model, and Yao Chen, another actress, celebrity, have both tweeted messages that are slightly cryptic, but very clearly in support of the newspaper. There has been a very broad base of support from all kinds of people that you may not have expected.
Pretty much as the unrest was going on at Southern Weekend, the editors of a historical journal published a cover article that argued that the existing constitution offered a basis for political reform. Last Friday, the magazine's website was shut down. Officials claimed that it failed to update its registration. How much does China's constitution play into this?
Constitutionalism, the idea of a constitution, was one of the very important strands of thinking of many Chinese intellectuals after the Qing Dynasty ended in 1911, and they looked at France and they looked at the United States with admiration. In the 1920s, the Communist Party of China, in at least one official document, adopts the idea of constitutionalism as an aim. It's a topic that the government is paranoid about, and it does have an appeal to a broader public, I think. How broad, I'm not sure.
So what does this constitution have to say about free speech?
The Chinese constitution guarantees all kinds of rights, like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly and religion, and all kinds of rights that you don't actually enjoy in China. If you really hold the government to account according to the words that you can read in the Chinese constitution, which you can buy in any bookstore anywhere in the country, it can make the government a little bit uncomfortable.
Even the government has invoked its own constitution from time to time, thus painting itself potentially into an eventual corner.
You know, Brooke, the name of the country is the People's Republic of China. How is that not painting yourself into a corner?
At the demonstrations, apparently some pro-government demonstrators held up signs reading, "Southern Weekend has an American dream. We don't want the American dream. We want the Chinese dream." So what is the Chinese dream actually about these days?
Xi Jinping, the new general secretary of the Communist Party and leader of China, talked about fulfilling the Chinese dream as one of his ambitions. But what exactly is the Chinese dream is very difficult to define. The American dream is something that anyone can understand. You know, you work hard, you get rich, you succeed. It's so simple. There's not really a Chinese dream in any coherent sense like there's an American dream. But the government is trying to use this idea of a Chinese dream as a kind of a propaganda rallying call. I don't think it has any resonance with real Chinese people, though.
Thanks again, Jeremy.
Ciao, Brooke.
Jeremy Goldkorn is the director of Danwei, a firm that researches Chinese media and the internet. The Southern Weekly was back on newsstands in China on Thursday with an investigation of a fire at an orphanage and discussions of proposed changes to labor camp and farmland seizure laws. Last month in India, a young woman was gang raped and murdered
a tragedy that has inflamed the entire country. She and a male friend were taking a bus home after a trip to see the movie Life of Pi when they were brutally attacked by five adult men and one juvenile riding the bus. After she was raped, she and her companion were beaten with an iron rod and left for dead on the side of the road. Outraged by the government's less than aggressive response to the incident, protesters took to the streets.
It's hard to believe that this is the state of my country, and that's why I couldn't sit back anymore.
Both national and international media have closely followed the event, fueling demands for a fast-tracked trial and reform to India's laws governing rape. After what many saw as a sluggish process, six men have now been formally charged with murder and rape. On Monday, dozens of reporters joined lawyers and spectators to see the accused in court. Naharika Mandana, a reporter for the New Delhi Bureau of the New York Times, was part of the press corps crammed into that courtroom, and she was present when the local magistrate brought the hammer down on the press.
And she passed an order saying that the court hall would have to be vacated, not just that day, but from that day till the end of the trial, and that the media would not be allowed to print or publish any information connected with the court proceedings. And then she said that the police had an apprehension as to the safety of the accused. There was no safe passage. They didn't know how to bring the accused to the witness box, given the large group of people that had congregated.
One can certainly understand how the crowding in the courtroom would pose a danger to both the defendants and the proceedings. But none of these reasons seem to justify a ban on reporting on the proceedings, even if the reporters aren't allowed into the courtroom.
In her order, she doesn't specifically address the issue of gagging the media. The argument that the prosecutor made when asking for the gag order was that there are details that would compromise the identity of the family and the details of the crime, which is an undesirable situation, if not unlawful.
Because the notion is that the victim and her family should be protected, but in this case, the victim is dead and the family is fine with having her name out there as a symbol of systemic failure, right?
Right, and that's what's being challenged. That's what a lot of lawyers who are challenging the order are saying, that this is just being used by the police who wants to wriggle out of the scrutiny situation, using all sorts of excuses to gag the media and take the public pressure off of them.
One lawyer who's challenging the order, who you quote, Kumar Mishra, says that the entire system is being judged, not just the police who first responded to the crime, but also the doctors who treated the woman.
It has emerged during the last 3 weeks of investigation, etc., that the police may not have responded to the first call, that there was an unreasonable delay in the police appearing at the scene of the crime. And then the male companion who survived the attack has said that police officers fought over jurisdiction while you have these two wounded people lying on a roadway. And then there's also been a whole debate about whether the medical treatment she received was good enough, whether she should have been moved out of the country from Delhi to Singapore when she was in a fragile state. So lawyers who are challenging the order say we need to know what else contributed, if anything, to her death. And without the trial being open and without the media having access to some of these records and facts, that these things will be suppressed and never be known.
Right now, there are a number of different narratives about the incident floating around. If reporters aren't allowed to report, who controls the narrative?
There are at least five or six different versions of the facts at the moment. And without official briefings from any of the involved parties, be it the police or the court or the family, it's tough to ascertain what the facts are and who is conjuring up stories. I mean, every day the media print, he says X and she says Y, but is not allowed access to the court, or if the court at the end of the day does not sit down with the media and say, this is what you learned and this is what we're allowed to share with you, I don't know how a cohesive and accurate narrative of what happened will emerge.
I guess it is a reflex, maybe for this program, to be offended by the largest democracy in the world gagging the press. I'm not talking about barring them from the courtroom, but gagging them from discussing a case of so much importance.
I think that that is the sense in the media as well as lawyers. This was challenged first before a district judge, now before the High Court. There is a large contingent that believes that there is nothing to warrant this sort of gag A, and B, that there is good reason why details of this case should be in the public domain. And this is a fight that's going to be fought over the next couple of weeks. But at this point, it remains uncertain.
Naharika, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Naharika Mandana is a reporter for the New York Times India Bureau in New Delhi. When Al Jazeera paid a reported $500 million last week to buy the chronically underwatched Current TV, a U.S. cable network partly owned by Al Gore, it was really buying itself potential placement in front of some 40 million pairs of American eyeballs each night. Whether that's a good deal remains to be seen, but it reaffirms the lengths, financial and otherwise, that Al Jazeera's primary funder, the government of Qatar, is willing to go to expand the network's reach. In its more than 16 years as a news network, Al Jazeera has angered nearly every government it's covered. But as it tries to introduce itself to American audiences as a credible news source, it's also fighting accusations that its primary funder is dictating that coverage, especially, critics say, in its coverage of the last few years of uprisings in the Arab world.
That accusation is increasingly heard even within Al Jazeera. A number of longtime employees have quit in protest, including correspondents in Beirut, Cairo, Moscow, Paris, and Berlin. When asked last year why he'd just quit, the Berlin correspondent, Aktham Suleiman, said, quote, "We at Al Jazeera were always proud to say we're financed by Qatar, but the state never interferes with our reporting. Now we suddenly find ourselves in a situation in which our reporting is precisely aligned with Qatari foreign policy." We reached out to Suleiman for an interview, but he politely declined because of his facility with English. We did talk last August to Sultan Al-Qasimi, a blogger and political commentator who expressed many of the same critiques of Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, the second biggest Arab satellite news channel, owned by members of the Saudi royal family. For a stark example, he says, look no further than Syria.
For instance, Al Jazeera and Arabiya would host individuals who would speak for 15, 20 minutes about events on the ground when they were not even in the country. Sometimes, even if they were in the country, they would be hundreds of miles away from the scene of events. The background of some of these activists is never investigated. The channels do not give disclaimers about them not being able to verify these videos or these claims. There have been reports for over a year now that there are elements of extreme Sunni Islamist groups that have been operating in Syria. However, these have never been reported in either of the channels. There is a pattern that we noticed with them being clearly sympathetic of the rebels. I must say that I am personally sympathetic to anyone trying to bring down this evil regime, but that is not the job of a channel that I'm supposed to turn to for neutral news.
Maybe the most astonishing example of what you've just described is the appearance, I think on both channels, of the cleric Adnan Al-Aror. He's presented as a kind of disinterested voice on the subject, but has said the most incendiary things about the Assad regime and the Alawite minority that supports him.
And their clamor to host anyone who will criticize the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad, the channels have gone to an unprecedented low by hosting a vile cleric who has said the most horrific things about a minority, a sect that is part and parcel of the community, that is Syria. He's encouraging people to take revenge on them.
To quote, mince them in meat grinders and feed their flesh to the dogs.
Amongst other things.
At Al Jazeera, the guy running the Syrian desk is the brother of a leader in the Syrian National Council, which sounds innocuous enough, but it happens to be the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria.
They go by different last names in order to hide this affiliation. This also builds into a very strong relationship between Al Jazeera and the Muslim Brotherhood organization, not only in Syria, but also in Egypt and elsewhere.
Now, to be clear here, finding fault with a pro-rebel slant at Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya does not equal defending the Bashar al-Assad regime.
This regime is evil. It has caused the deaths of 20,000 people at least. My sympathies lie with the people who want to see the end of this regime. However, I refuse to be sold a story that is in one way or the other curated for the benefit of one party or the other.
Sultan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Political commentator Sultan Al-Qasimi wrote about Syria coverage on foreignpolicy.com. We contacted Al Jazeera for comment, and it responded, quote, Al Jazeera's coverage of the Arab awakening has been acclaimed, award-winning, and appreciated by viewers the world over. All the uprisings from Tunisia and Egypt through to Syria have been approached with the same principles and vigor. However, each time, conspiracy theorists have levied the same simultaneous accusations of lack of coverage or exaggeration. This is due to our Arabic channel's importance as the most watched news outlet in the Arab world. We cover Syria as many international channels do, and it can't be that they are all doing so at the behest of the Qatar government. You have to deal with the facts on the ground, and that's what we always do in our reporting.
Coming up, a look at a baker's dozen of British kids who have grown up before our very eyes, and the filmmaker who's followed them for 49 years.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, working to help states evaluate the impact of tax incentives on jobs and the economy, at PewTrust.org. And the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University, at CySimsFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield, with a few clarifications. First up, in our television show from a few weeks ago, we spoke with TV critic Alan Sepinwall about a renaissance in scripted dramatic television. He does not, as I said, write for HitFlix.com. He writes for HitFix.com. And in an interview we did last month with news anchor Bill Ritter about the ethics of interviewing children who've witnessed a tragedy, several listeners wrote in to correct my use of the term automatic weapon fire in the Sandy Hook massacre. Actually, according to police, the popping sounds I referred to came from a semi-automatic weapon. However, I stand by my characterization. In the weapons trade, the terms automatic and semi-automatic are often used by experts interchangeably.
In 1964, a British documentary profiled the lives of 14 seven-year-olds. It was called Seven Up.
There's Nicholas. And Tony. Jackie and her friends.
The 40-minute television broadcast was intended in part to illustrate Britain's entrenched class system, borrowed from the old Jesuit motto,
give me a child until he is seven, and I will give you the man.
Michael Apted, who's since directed such feature films as Coal Miner's Daughter and Gorillas in the Mist, was a 22-year-old assistant on that project, which he has since expanded into a stunning longitudinal series. Every 7 years, he directs a new documentary that revisits those former seven-year-olds, a project known collectively as the Up Series. In 2012, Apted visited them for the 8th time in the appropriately titled 56 Up. Apted says that for the first installment, he was instructed to find children across the socioeconomic spectrum because it seemed the social order might finally be crumbling.
It was made in 1963-64, at a time when English society might be changing. You know, we had the rock and roll and we had fashion and great literature and art going on, and maybe the cultural barriers were breaking down. And this was really a look at England, not through the eyes of professionals, but through the eyes of seven-year-old children.
One of your subjects, a man named Neil, starts out as a bright-eyed would-be astronaut, and he grows into a wanderer, a lost soul. In 56 Up, he quotes a line he says is from Albert Camus, that life is what happens when you're waiting for something else.
It's quite a nifty way of looking at life, that you're not always sure which way it's going and suddenly it creeps up on you, which I think is really true of everybody. I think that's one of the lessons, if you can call it that, from the series.
So can you generalize about your subjects? It seems that despite the regrets of some and the satisfactions of others, they've all managed to find some kind of equilibrium.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I frankly thought the film might be depressing. I thought people would be worried a lot about the state of the nation and fearing the future. But no, it was a much more positive film, I thought. And I really didn't know until I'd almost done it. Each film tends to have a slightly different tone. And there seemed to be a kind of peacefulness about it.
Even Neil, where you didn't see satisfaction, you at least saw a kind of acceptance.
Yeah, with him a questioning acceptance. I mean, he was pretty rough on me. You know, he told me I really didn't know anything about him, which is also true.
There's been tremendous goodwill towards the series. But I'm also aware that I'm not the only participant who wants to set the record straight. For so many millions of people, I'm here wearing my heart on my sleeve. And they think they know absolutely everything about me. I mean, there were countless people writing me saying, I know exactly how you feel. And actually, from those letters, I would say none of them, not a single one of them, knew exactly how I was feeling.
I don't know really anything about these good souls, except I've worked with them for 50 years and I see them a few days every 7 years.
I appreciated the fact that you let your subjects attack you. In particular, one of the upper-class kids, John, has likened it to taking a poison pill every 7 years. And yet, all but one of the 14 original participants have stuck with it, if not in every episode.
It takes some convincing sometimes, but the film is very well received wherever it plays. And in a way, I think we're all sneaky proud of it. And there's a loyalty and a trust between us.
Trust? Really? I mean, speaking of John, he said that you had completely distorted him.
Insofar as the program touches me, I feel it's a complete fraud.
I read The Observer and The Times. What do you like about it? I usually look at the headlines and then read about them.
When I leave the school, I'm going to College Court. And then I will be going to Westminster Boarding School if I pass the exam. And then we think I'm going to Cambridge and Trinity Hall.
It all appeared part of some indestructible birthright. What viewers were never told is that my father died when I was age 9, leaving my mother in very uncomfortable financial circumstances, and that I got a scholarship to Oxford.
Did you leave that out on purpose?
No, I didn't know it, actually. But, I mean, I still don't think that really undermines my argument about him. I think he was given a strong, firm, guiding hand in life, where a lot of other people in the film weren't, because he came from a very empowered background.
Let's play a clip from Simon, who is a foundling at 7. Here he is at 14, talking about what he wants to be when he grows up.
Was going to be a film star, but now I'm going to be an electrical engineer. Just more to reality, really.
By 21, Simon was working in the freezer room of Wall Sausages in London.
So that says a lot, right? That says he didn't get close
to being a movie star.
Or even an electrical engineer. And yet, when we look at Simon's life, he was a foundling. He's helping foster children who adore him and his wife. He's close with his family. He seems to have a profound sense of satisfaction.
Well, exactly. And I had to learn, in a sense, not to impose my sort of middle-class neurosis of success and failure on everybody else, that everybody had their own dream of life. And what Simon did, what Simon learned about, you know, there was the other things in life that he wanted to achieve. And as you say, he achieved them perfectly.
One of the things I appreciate so much about the film is how you do reveal yourself periodically. And I wonder, did you have a cringe or a second thought when you phrased the question to Simon?
And you never feel you should be doing better jobs than these? Aren't you worth more than this?
No, I haven't really. I suppose I just like hard work. I don't know.
I didn't cringe. I like asking direct questions.
I mean, what the question implies, that worth is
yes.
connected to the job.
Yes, I don't believe that, and I was interested whether he believed it. And to a certain extent, he did believe it.
If I'd pushed myself at school, probably I could have done a lot better.
Does that give you pause for thought?
No, that means I was a lazy sod when I was younger.
50 years ago, this was intended to be about the class system. How much did class play a role in how they turned out in the
end?
Well,
I think for that generation, quite a lot. Class has changed. If I'd started the film 10 years, 15 years later, I think it would have been fairly different. There's still more class birth issues, I think, in England than in other countries. But I don't think it's as suffocating as it was. And, you know, one of the big moments for me in the history of the film is when I first brought it to America. I didn't want to bring it here because Americans won't understand it. They won't understand the social context. But anyway, I was persuaded to show it, and it came here and played at the Los Angeles Film Festival and the New York Film Festival, and Americans understood it. And I realized that I was doing something different from what I thought I was doing. I wasn't making a film about the residue of the English political system, as it were. I was making a film about characters, about people, about universal issues, things that we all have to deal with. And that, for me, was a very freeing moment.
One of my very favorite characters, and they are characters to me, is Tony.
Tony was brought up in the East End of London.
I want to be a jockey when I grow up.
At 14, he was already an apprentice at Tommy Gosling's racing stable at Epsom.
What will you do if you don't make it as a jockey?
I don't know. If I knew I couldn't be one, I'd get out of the game.
Well, what do you think you would do then?
Run on taxis.
And by 28, he owned his own cab.
Tony, in his early days, is a quintessential scallywag. I understand that you thought he might be the one most likely to end up in jail.
It didn't happen, but at 21, he was running around dog tracks laying bets for people. And I looked at that and I thought, this guy really doesn't have much chance in life. And so I played God, and in preparation for if at 28 he was in prison, I took him around the East End of London, or he took me around in his cab, pointing out all the big crime spots. It was an absurd thing to do, but I learned a big lesson from that. I start with a blank page. Just because they said something in 49, that doesn't mean they have to answer the same question in 56. I just don't want it to be an update. But it was that lesson I learned with Tony that was very profound for me and really helped guide me through this.
Tony, please come in here. Ladies and gentlemen, Tony Walker.
Hello.
Bravo. Put on their headphones.
Hello, America.
So, when you saw yourself in these films, 50 years, did you recognize yourself?
Absolutely, I recognized myself. I mean, I was always a East End boy with my arse hanging out my trousers. I had no guidance, early doors. My dad was inside and out of prison. But where I was 14 going into the stables, it was quite regimental, and all the rough edges of my character were sort of cut, and I become what I would consider respectable.
And I must say, this is news to me, really, about the effect of being in the stables. So you learn something every minute.
in the early scenes when you're seven, you know, you're sitting at your desk and you keep looking back and the teacher keeps going, Tony.
Tony, don't turn around again.
It's funny, I'm a London cabbie now. People are still talking behind my back. And the characteristics I had then at seven. And you look at my characteristics now at 56, nothing has changed really.
Michael, why did you pick Tony?
He just seemed an irresistible character. He had a lot of energy. He was funny. And I thought he would give the program a good kick up the backside.
Would you pick yourself at age seven?
No, I don't think I ever spoke at the age of seven, so I don't think I would have qualified.
What was your first impression, Tony, of Michael?
In 1963, just after the assassination of Kennedy, the cameras came. Consequently, in them days, we had shilling pieces. It's like a dime you put in the electric meter. Well, my mum had no money at that particular time, and Michael, my brother, was arguing who was going to put the shilling pieces in the slot machine to make the electric power for the cameras. I remember that so clearly.
Did I put the shilling in the meter or did your brother?
You did, Michael.
Thank God for that.
I still remember. stays with you for the rest of your life.
Do you think it changed the course of your life in any way?
Not for one moment. I mean, if you got a bit of string and put one straight line, I'd be still in a straight line where I'd have ended up now, whether the cameras are there or not.
I sort of think it's a testament to the films. I don't think it's changed any of their lives. It's had an effect on them. But, you know, I think, you know, they've lived the lives that they were going to live.
Let's play a clip from a 2007 episode of The Simpsons called Springfield Up. A filmmaker named Declan Desmond is interviewing Homer and Marge for a longitudinal documentary called Growing Up Springfield.
Well, Marge, you must be proud of your homie.
Oh, yes, I'm so proud. I feel my chest might burst. Can you edit that? I don't want to say chest in a movie.
You said it, and it stays. Are you two considering children?
Kids, no way. You'll never see a couple of rugrats tying me down.
Okay, then the scene suddenly changes to an older Marge and Homer with babies. It's Lisa and Bart. Lisa, you might hear her pacifier.
You better not put this shot after the one where I said I won't have kids. That would be a devastating edit.
But you would have, right?
Certainly. I have to put enough of the older stuff in so everybody gets the idea of how these people have grown and changed and whatever, and, you know, had great moments when they've contradicted themselves or said something funny or whatever. Those moments that lovers of the series always expect to see.
Is there any juxtaposition, any choice you made that you regret?
Well, I always get the chance to put it right, you know, by doing the next one. I mean, as we've discussed the Tony fiasco, I'm sure I've made lots of mistakes and behaved insensitively. But whatever rough times we've had, we're still, in a sense, bonded like some bizarre family with this thing.
Tony, do you see the series as a kind of photo album?
It's funny. When I get Michael, after the 7 years he sits me down, it's like me going to sort of therapy. And I sort of just tell him everything that's happening, the truthful answer that I give.
Did you know he was worried about you?
No, I don't know. I trust Michael implicitly, and he knows that.
It wasn't actually quite as exciting as some of the previous films, but maybe in our mid-50s, we just aren't.
Well, maybe, but I'm sort of not particularly looking for that. You know, it's like a sort of great Victorian novel. You know, people move half an inch a year. You know, it's the heroism of ordinary life.
There's something about the 50s that's really different, but it does seem like everyone has entered a phase where the struggle abates and you just live because you can see the end of it.
Well, it sort of thrilled me and flabbergasted me that's true of this, but I don't know. And again, now I'm starting to play God. I don't know what the future holds for myself. You know, I'm in my 70s now. I'm panicking about the future. It's interesting that, you know, there's a lot of politics in this particular film. They're all talking about the economic situation a lot, more than any other of the films in the series. But there was a huge recession in when they were in their 30s, when we were doing 35 up. But it didn't matter to them if they had their future. But now at 56, an economic recession means a lot. Are their pensions going to go belly up? Are they going to have any money left for their retirement and all this? Again, I was thrilled with this one that it was so positive. But I'm I'm wondering when we get to 63 and 70 with them, whether they'll be quite so placid about the future. I'm certainly not.
You're 15 years older than your subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Have you named an heir?
No, I mean, Claire Lewis has been with us since 28. She's as close as I am, maybe closer to some of them than I am. So if I pegged out or lost my marbles, she would be the obvious one to carry it on.
But you hope you could get to...
Well, I know what I hope. I hope to do 84 up when I'll be 99. And then we'll call it quits.
We'll be both going down to the post office, Michael, drawing our pension books together then.
I'm already doing that.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tony, thank you too.
Thank you. You're more than welcome.
Michael Apted is the director of the Up series. Tony Walker has appeared in all 8 installments of the series. We'll end with these thoughts from 2 other participants, Nick and Susie.
Why is it that we are so annoyed about this program? The idea of looking at a bunch of people over time and how they evolve, that was a really nifty idea. It isn't a picture really of the essence of Nick or Susie. It's a picture of every man. And that's the value of it.
But then we're putting ourselves out to be that person. I don't know what happened. I was quite adamant I wasn't going to do it. I suppose I have this ridiculous sense of loyalty to it, even though I hate it.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Krista Ripple. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.